Drive Time on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Zurich. We believe small actions can have great impact. Take a small action today. Speak to a financial broker about a Zurich pension.
2,000 small and medium landlords leave the market every year, according to figures from the Residential Tenancies Board. But the knock-on impact frequently leaves their tenants struggling to find alternative accommodation in a very squeezed market where rents are sky high. To discuss this problem and possibly some innovative solutions, I'm joined now by Head of Policy and Communications with the Simon Community, that's Wayne Stanley, and to give us an outside perspective from Cambridge, Massachusetts, City Councillor Mark McGovern, who's helped to implement some novel solutions to the supply of social housing there. You're both very welcome to the programme. I might start with you, Wayne Stanley, because you're really at the coalface here of this problem, aren't you? I mean, in your opinion, how big a problem is it that landlords are selling up and leaving the rental market altogether?
It's a very big problem in the current where we currently are. I mean, what we know is, and we've known for a number of years, is that the vast number of families are coming into homelessness, families in particular, but families and individuals coming into homelessness, are coming from the private rental sector. My colleagues in Focus Ireland have done some really innovative research, which has actually shown that it's not just those people who are presenting to local authorities and saying, my landlord is selling up, I'm about to become homeless. It's also, what they did was look behind that, and it's also people who are saying, I'm coming because of family breakup. And when you actually look back, they've moved in with other family members in unsustainable, overcrowded situations because they were forced out of the private rental market and went into family on a temporary basis. Mm-hmm. So we've seen this for a number of years. I mean, there is one ray of light in this, is that over the period of the pandemic, when there was a moratorium on evictions, we saw a big decrease in the number of families in homelessness over that period. Now, it started to increase already, again, in the number of families coming in, but it does point to the fact that there are solutions to the homeless problem.
And I know you have proposals in that regard, and we'll come to those in just a second. But fewer landlords then basically means that more families are going into homelessness. That's what you're seeing and experiencing, is it?
Yes, and I think we have to be, I suppose, conscious of the fact that there's a historical perspective to this. The immediate impact is yes, that's absolutely true. The historical perspective to this is, if we went back to 2004, we've seen an increase, a growth in the private rental market, and the private rental market has continued to grow. It's only the last couple of years we've started to see it fall off. What has happened in the interim is the state hasn't been building public housing, and through supplements such as the housing assistant payment or through using leasing schemes, local authorities have been buying and buying into the private rental market to meet social housing need. And now when the private rental market starts to see a fallback, the domino effect is really severe and is seeing increases in homelessness.
Okay. What about the argument put forward by landlords? And it's been done in this program even this week, that if you allow landlords keep more of the rental income, certainly don't put a cap on them, they say, but if you allow them to keep a little bit more of the rental income, they wouldn't be exiting the market as much. I mean, are you experiencing, in your experience, I should say, would that bear fruit in any way in terms of allowing them to stay in the market and increasing supply?
I wouldn't dismiss it out of hand. But what I would say is we need to be mindful of, careful about the noise in this. I mean, rents are at record highs. And what we see from research that was done and conducted for the Residential Tenancies Board and similar research done around Europe is that at any one time, about 30% of landlords say they want to get out of the market. Particularly those small landlords, which are a huge part of the Irish, with over 86% of landlords have one and two properties. So the issue now is in part that landlords are leaving, but there's also that other landlords are not coming in. And that brings us back to the need for more housing and the fact that the cost of housing is so high, mm-hmm. that the return on rentals isn't there. So I think for me, it fundamentally goes back to the need for the state to be building public housing on public land as the absolute solution.
Okay, stay with me, Wayne Stanley of the Simon Community, for just a moment. I'll come back to your proposals in just a second, but you might be interested to hear what Mark McGovern has to say. Mark is the city councillor for Cambridge, Massachusetts. Mark, you're very welcome to Drive Time, and thank you very much indeed for joining us. You've been listening to Wayne and using terms that are all too familiar with you, because you have a housing crisis in Massachusetts for some time, haven't you? And you used to have rent controls as well.
Yes, we thank you. First of all, thank you for having me. And we did. Cambridge, Boston, and Brookline, three, Cambridge and Brookline being two cities just outside of Boston, had rent control for years. And then in 1994, it was placed on the question of whether or not to keep rent control was placed on a statewide ballot. And it only lost, it was, rent control was defeated by, I think it was a 51-49 margin or something, you know, as close as that. But you had a lot of cities and towns in Massachusetts voting on it, even though they didn't actually have it themselves.
Which is amazing, in a referendum that they abolished rent controls. And what effect did that have, Mark?
So we saw, it was sort of a perfect storm in Cambridge. Right around this time, in the mid-90s, we lost rent control. So we lost the government's ability to regulate rents. And at the same time, Kendall Square, which is one of our sort of commercial center, was really starting to boom in biotech and innovation, the innovation economy. And so there are a lot of people moving into Cambridge who were making more money than the people who worked in the manufacturing factories that were there before. Mm-hmm. So you had more people moving into the city who were higher earners. With the loss of rent control, many families sold their property or converted to condominiums. And so you saw a reduction in the number of apartments that were available, an increase in the number of people coming to Cambridge, and you lost the government's ability to regulate rents. All that sort of came together, and rents just, you know, went through the roof.
So rents went through the roof, and you had lower social housing supply. All familiar to us at the moment, Mark, all of what you're saying. You had some ideas in as to how to increase affordable housing and accommodation and social housing as well. Tell us about inclusionary zoning.
Right. So after the loss of rent control, the first thing the city did was passed this ordinance in what we call inclusionary zoning or inclusionary housing. And what that is that for any market rent housing that is built in the city that is over 10 units, a percentage of those units have to be considered affordable, and they are sort of given over to the city's affordable housing program. They're completely subsidized by the developer. It's really no cost to the city at all. In exchange for that, the developer will get some extra height to offset the what is essentially considered a loss of those units. And over the years, that has resulted in, we probably have close to 1,200 units, affordable units, that have come from that.
Okay,
in Cambridge,
inclusionary zoning, Mark, basically, the amount of affordable units was increased. You also had another innovation, affordable housing overlay. You might explain that one to us.
Sure. So that's something that just passed last year. It was an effort that I led with a couple other councillors. And land costs in Cambridge are outrageously expensive, and it often prevents affordable housing developers from being able to buy property and build. And so what we did was we said, if you build 100% affordable housing, and it must remain affordable in perpetuity, we will give you extra height, extra density, and we will streamline the permitting process so that your projects do not get caught up in the bureaucratic red tape. And that way, it made it more financially viable for affordable housing developers to purchase property. And within this year, since it passed. We have 400 units of 100% affordable housing that are currently in the pipeline to be built under the overlay.
So that is interesting. So if a developer wants to build affordable housing, you say if it's 100% affordable housing, you can have more of it, higher, more high-rise and more dense units per square metre, per se. And also under inclusionary zoning, it's quite interesting that you're getting private developers then delivering more social housing. Is that right?
Yeah. And so market in Cambridge is just ridiculous. And whether it's commercial or residential, people want to develop here. And so we can require them to do all kinds of things and they'll still come because they're still going to make money. So it's about $600,000 a unit to build a unit here in Cambridge. And so if you think of, you know, 1,200 units of affordable housing, that's, you know, well over $600 million of affordable housing that the city is essentially getting for free. And so you have folks who are low income who are living, you know, on the 15th floor of a building overlooking the city of Boston in an apartment that on the market would probably go for $3,000 or $4,000, and they're paying 30% of their income, which might only be $800 a month. Okay. The rest of that is completely subsidized by the developer.
Okay, some really interesting ideas. Stay with me, Mark, for a second. I'll go back to Wayne Sandley. Do you hear anything there, Wayne, that could be of use here, in your opinion?
Yeah, I hear some really interesting ideas. I suppose I'd have 100 questions around sustainability and whether those units are developers getting around it in any way or all those kind of things in terms of size. But the idea that we leverage planning to ensure that the state gets the accommodation for at a zero rate seems to me much more progressive than some of the ways that we've been doing it, where we continue to buy from developers. But obviously, we'd have to look at the consequences. But it's certainly interesting things and interesting ideas there.
Let me bring you some reaction to the conversation so far from listeners. Paul says, I just today gave notice to my tenant family, whom are with me for 5 years. My yield after expenses and taxes is 1.5%. I don't need the hassle for that return. The private rental market for small landlords is broken. Many more will leave, he says. One more. I'm a landlord. What your rep from Simon has to realise is that although rent is at an all-time high, this also means tax paid to revenue is at an all-time high because you're charged tax pro rata. What do you say to those who text, Wayne?
They're right. I mean, I'm not here to attempting to vilify landlords in any way. I think the broader point I was trying to make is that those small landlords in the past, they got into the market to seeing the properties as an investment. And we're willing to take those hits. So the broader point I'm making is that we need to rethink how we think about the private rental market and turn it into a sustainable place for people to live.
They might like your proposal, though, because you have a proposal to government to basically stop people being evicted into homelessness. Isn't that right?
Yeah. So we're looking at, so next week we have Simon Week, which is a week where we look at the solutions to homelessness, we look at the challenges, and obviously this year we're very focused on the new plan, Housing for All. What we're doing, as I was saying earlier, during COVID, with the moratorium on evictions, we saw a big fall in particularly in family homelessness, and that's because we were able to keep people in their home. What we're seeing now is those numbers start to creep up again. The proposal that we have that we're hopeful the government might engage with is a prevention bill which says for those people that we see who are coming into, have been in the private rental market, have get a valid notice, have been attempting to find some place to live. A lot of them, they never expect that homelessness is going to happen to them. And what they're doing is it comes down to the last 2 weeks and the crisis hits and they realise that they're going to have to present to homeless services.
Okay, so they're coming to you far too late in order for you to help them.
What we're looking at is that they would present to the local authority. The local authority would then have the power to adjudicate whether this person is at imminent risk of homelessness. If that adjudication is made, they would get an extension to their notice to quit of 12 weeks. What that would allow is the local authority and agencies like Simon and Threshold to work with the person and divert them from homelessness.
Okay.
We're not denying it's an imposition on landlords, but I think as part of the social contract of addressing homelessness, I think it's a fair balance.
Okay, and we'll see what landlords have to say about that on 51551. I might go back to Mark McGovern briefly, Mark, and ask you, there's a protest, a demonstration outside our parliament here today because of a student accommodation crisis as well. And I know in recent times you've been calling on universities like MIT and Harvard in Massachusetts to play their part in solving the accommodation crisis there. But we had a vice president, of a leading university here just today say that even if the university could borrow vast sums of money, it wouldn't be feasible or viable for them to build student accommodation because construction costs are simply far too high.
Yeah, I mean, this is a conversation we get into both with Harvard and MIT, and there's a little bit of a difference. MIT actually has a very extensive for-profit real estate division. So a lot of the commercial buildings and lab space in those buildings that are in our commercial district are actually owned by MIT. And so that revenue that gets generated gives them, you know, more funding to build student housing. And typically what will happen is they will come to the city council and say, could we have some zoning relief to build a taller building or what have you? And then we enter into a negotiation with them to say, sure, you want to build a taller commercial building where you're going to make a ton of money. That's great. You also have to build some student housing or public housing along with that. And so that's kind of a negotiation that we often get into mm-hmm. with them, more MIT than Harvard, because Harvard doesn't do as much around building commercial and taxable real estate. So
so that conversation
certainly
is
in any university town, the student population has an impact on the housing market.
Well, that is definitely the situation here as well. Look, we might talk again soon because it's good to get an outside perspective. It's happening where you are and certainly here as well, the housing crisis. Mark McGovern, City Councillor for Cambridge, Massachusetts, thank you very much indeed. And also Wayne Stanley.
Thank you. And Wayne, get my contact info. I've got some ideas.
That's good. Any solutions, welcome. Wayne Stanley of Simon Community, thank you as well.